This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and publishing. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Carl Gartung and Anne Kingsbury. They're the founders of Woodland Pattern, which is a nonprofit literary organization in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I have the pleasure of saying that I've known them since they began, and possibly even a little bit before they began, through a variety of connections in the Midwest and poetry and publishing. So maybe you could talk a little bit about just the background, your backgrounds individually, and how you got, where the idea come from to start a literary organization back in 19, well, you started in 79, but you started thinking about it before then. So we're talking about a long time ago, and you were the only ones thinking about this then, and you're the only ones doing it now.
Okay. Well, I think it was 1976. Carl Jung and Tom Montag had a bookstore called Books Incorporated, which was not yet nonprofit. And it was a small press bookstore. And I think Leonard Randolph started a pilot program at the NEA for distribution of small press literature. And so they applied and got a grant for their bookstore and hired me to be kind of a babysitter. And I'd come out of college. I was a big fan of William Carlos Williams and et cetera. But I'd had a terrifically hard time following up, since I was also a full-time kind of theater guy. I built sets and stuff. So I would look in bookstores and see the same 50 titles over and over again, and mostly, you know, everything from Rod McEwen to Robert Frost, and making no judgments here, no interested in the first, and diminishing interest in the second.
That's good.
And so when I got hired to do this bookstore, I'd always heard about small presses, but heard them called vanity presses, and I really didn't know much about them. I came from Nebraska, and so all that stuff was going overhead as far as I could tell. And I walked in the store, and then all of a sudden, here is Charles Olson and all the Black Mountain poets and the Objectivists and all the some of the feminist presses, and it was I'm saying all of this stuff. It was like 50 titles in this bookstore, and then some titles from both Carl and Tom, Jerome Rothenberg and George Oppen and up and down the line. And during the interview, after they decided I might be worthy of knowing something, they suggested that I might want to read Laureen Nitecker, since she'd lived in Milwaukee, which I did. I had a lot of time because they were tearing up the street in front of the store.
So you had no customers.
No customers. So, but we had this money. We ordered books and then it would take me a couple of weeks to unpack, you know, the three boxes of books that would come in from SPD or from truck distribution books. What was that one?
Joe Richardson's book, book truck. I forget what they called it.
Right.
From Fargo.
Because
we were part of the Ford Foundation funded the Coordinating Council of Literary Magazines to do pilot project in literary small press distribution. Mm-hmm. So CCLM gave some money to me and Joe and Joe Flaherty and a bunch of other, not that many others, but a few others. And so we were a source of books you couldn't get anywhere else.
Right. So since I had a lot of time, I sat down to read Truck 16 one afternoon, edited by the gentleman across the table here. And knocked my teeth out. it was like immediately apparent to me. You know, I mean, I always thought that things had kind of stopped with Williams. I didn't see anybody doing that kind of work, it was all confessional and all that stuff. And And so this was like the illumination for me. It was like, this is where I belong. And so we started out and couldn't figure out how it was that I would get paid $5,000 to babysit this bookstore for a year and spend over $5,000 on books.
Were you working at that time? Weren't you teaching then?
I was teaching at the university.
Yeah, and so you were making some money.
Yes, and yes, we had insurance.
Still spending it all.
Yes,
no,
and
I
couldn't
my
understand
money.
It. You know, I'd say, Carl, you don't have to have every book, and I was so wrong. You know, I've since learned that the error of my ways on that, but at the time I was less sympathetic than I could have been.
But you've always been you've been an artist in a kind of literary way, I would say.
That's fair. And I as I said, I taught art at the university, and I made things, so right. As an artist. And then I was a tenure casualty. And so we had to make a decision about. And it hadn't been that fabulous an experience. The teaching itself was fine. I'm not so hot with the bureaucracy.
So this was this after a couple of years of...
No. I was hired in 1976. My dad died, and while I was gone to attend his funeral in 76, she was told she wouldn't be getting tenure.
Right, so this was all at the same time.
Right.
Okay. But I already knew. You know, I mean, right. This was... we'd moved like what, five times in our first 7 years of marriage, and this was 1,500 pounds of clay. She was a ceramicist, and probably 500 pounds of paper, and then.
But how many pounds of books? Yeah,
we had a lot of books, so moving was not a light.
So that's why you decided to stay in Milwaukee.
I'd always wanted to do two things. I wanted to be involved in the theater and have a bookstore, this bookstore was in the lobby of a theater. How can you go wrong? You know, I mean, I was there.
So, but how did what happened to convert Tom and Carl's store to you being to you doing Woodland Pattern?
Well, Books Incorporated. Well, one of the first things I did was start. You know, I walked in the store. 90% of the writers were completely unfamiliar to me that were in the bookcases. And probably more than 90%. So I'm reading these things and having, you know, blowing my mind day after day. And I thought, well, if you just expand this and have these titles that other people like me are going to walk in and not know what they're seeing, that it would be a waste of motion. And so I thought we should have a book, a reading series. And I talked to a guy at the public library, Nolan Neds, who was a city assistant city librarian or whatever. And we wrote a grant to the NEA again and got a visiting writers program going. Number one was Paul Metcalf. And the Paul Metcalf, again, through the gentleman across the table, I met Paul Metcalf and Robert Creeley and Ed Dorn and a few others, and through Carl Jung, I met Diane Wachowski and Jerry Rothenberg and Jackson Maclow and a number of others, David Henderson, you know, on and on, and so we were off, you know, and BP Nickel.
Yes.
All right. So in that first year,
we had Four Horsemen.
And during the first few months I was working there, Dick Higgins walked in, who started Something Else Press. Talked me out of him getting a discount. He said people had to pay for books, then we became friends, so the attention got taken off into the performance. And it started forming the aesthetic of the bookstore right away then, because Carl Jung was interested in the book as a visual object, although not a fine visual object. And Tom Montag was more of a traditional publisher. And then Dick came along, and he's interested in the way literature would rub up against all the other arts, and so now the experience became John Cage and all the Fluxus and et cetera, ad infinitum. I'm still behind.
You know? But still, so now, but we still haven't gotten from.
Well, so now,
how does Woodland Pattern come to be?
Well, we started the reading series. Then we had some local readings that weren't at the library, and we had trouble with the theater company that was in the building. They found a way to always have a rehearsal when we'd had a scheduled reading and stuff, and that started to be a substantial irritant. And then they raised the rent on the building. There were two theater companies and us in the building, and all three of us together were paying $250 a month for this building, downtown Milwaukee. And so when the rent got, you know, I think it got tripled to begin
with. Well, it was realistic then.
Yeah.
Right. It went from being nothing to.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But
still, it was like unsustainable for us. So we had some friends. So we knew we had to move. And that was a good excuse to change the name, because Books, Inc., as charming upon as it is not substantial. I mean, it was Theater X, so Books with an X, Inc., you know, and it felt a little. So we started looking around for a name, and Paul Metcalf had published Appalachia as his gift to the nation, great son and grandson of Herman Melville.
Published by Jargon Society.
Right.
Jonathan Williams.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And so in Appalachia, I found a reference to the Woodland Pattern.
Which is the Midwest.
Yeah, the
native.
The region south of Lake Superior out to the Mississippi and up to Lake Michigan, down into Illinois. And that was named by, it turned out, the quote that he used was from a anthropologist at the Milwaukee Public Museum, which was a fine, American slash German style anthropology museum. It was terrific. And Robert Retzenthaler had coined the term Woodland Pattern. He broke up the central region of the country into several different patterns, but the Woodland Pattern was the one that, and it was a making and trading culture with pottery, but without agriculture.
Oh, yeah.
And so making and trading. And then Carl and I we debated about the names, but we liked Woodland Pattern because Milwaukee was a foundry city. And so wood patterns were all over the place. And there was considerable confusion over our name on that account.
Yeah.
And so we like that pun and that connection, we're looking for a name that would express the place we were from in as deep a sense as we could manage. And then we wanted the bookstore to be an examination of that place.
So you then found another building.
And
to move
then
into.
we had to find another building, and Anne had a little bit of retirement money, and we found a building that was within walking distance and also that we could afford, and moved into it and changed the name simultaneously.
Right, and that was 1979.
Yes.
Or 79 to 80. We actually opened in 80.
Yeah. Got it. Yeah. Okay.
But we started working on the building December 26th, 1979, and it took us 2 months to get to where people could come into one room. So it was a three storefront building. It had been.
Right, I remember you working on it room by room.
Yeah,
I do remember that because you did all the work yourselves.
Right.
Pretty much.
It was sweat equity.
Yeah.
And we had good friends come and help us. And then this was evil, but we had really the only good construction in the building was the way the tile was connected to the floor. And it was a nice wood floor underneath. Yeah. So we would chip the tile off by hand, and I would set the timer for 20 minutes, so I'd be on my knees, and then I would take a break. But we collected all these bags of tile and went back to Theater X's dumpster at night
and filled
their dumpster just to kind of make up for the fact that the bathrooms always were filled with makeup and stuff. We're much more moral
and
now.
And toilet paper.
So then you basically grew Woodland Pattern from that point.
From that point.
Right, from that early point on.
Yes.
And you know, it's still going today, obviously. But there's a so, and we won't be able to cover everything,
right,
you know, in this short period of time. So I guess some of my question, or maybe some of the best things we could talk about, would be, you know, what was it like for you at different points in time? You know, what were the kind of key points where things changed from being really? I mean, you were hand to mouth at the very beginning. You did all of this, as you said, sweat equity. You weren't being paid.
And we had people that were willing to give us books on consignment and to amplify the holding.
It made a huge difference.
Early on, I had a debate with a local artist about whether we should do a few spectacular events and then disappear, or whether, and my attitude was no, the thing to do would be to grow. There wasn't a big audience for what we were, by this time it was established, there wasn't a big audience for what we were doing. And I had noticed that all these books had been around for a long time, at least in manuscript form and a lot of times in book form, and were really good and beautiful work, and it took time for them to find an audience, and so to do something spectacular and disappear didn't seem to answer the need that was there.
No, in many ways, what I've noticed about Woodland Pattern, what seems to one of the markers of what you've done, is this commitment to the work that this, you know, over time. So it's anti-commercialism, but also anti-ephemerality, so that books that somebody sold you as I know I did in 1980,
77,
even earlier, if you didn't sell them, unlike anybody else, you didn't send them back, you didn't mark them down and try to get them out for 10 cents, you kept them in the store. Now, for a long time, I know this is true for a really long time, you sold them at the original price.
Yes.
So if I sold you a book and I think, let's say, Carl's book, that little Kalapuya book, which sold for $1.50, you sold it for $1.50, even though
for the next 15 years.
Yeah, yeah. By 1985 or 1995, no, not that long, but whatever it was.
Yeah, it was a while.
A long time.
Right.
You know, book prices have definitely risen. You know, the Black Sparrow books that we had in 1980, right, which were $3.50, you know, by the time he stopped, those would have been more like $15. So book prices went up quite a bit.
You didn't
reprice everything, which you could have done, until much later, when you realized that you were...
Well, Carl's idea about having things affordable, first of all, people don't know the work, and he wanted to make sure it would be available to kids that maybe didn't have a lot of money. When we started having dealers go away with armloads and then saying, you should have jacked the price on this, it made us look at it a little differently.
Right.
But for years, it was that kind of philosophy about making things accessible.
Right. Well, until you were discovered.
Yeah.
Because we did go through a period where those, like, objects are new, and then they, you know, kind of don't have as much value in this commercial space, and then they become collector's items.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then the price skyrockets. I mean, in relative terms,
yeah,
you know, we're talking about, you know, a book that might have sold for $5 then suddenly is worth $25. It's not like it's worth a million. But so at that point, your effort to keep those books affordable would be defeated by the collector's marketplace.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But still, you know, I think the value that you espouse that's we can notice there is, as you've said, the affordability, but it's also this, I think, for anybody in the book business, the difference is you keep the books, you know, you make them available, you're true to your, to the reason why you exist, which is to make unusual and challenging and sometimes not popular art and literature available, and let it remain available instead of disappearing into the night, which I think is really, you know, that's unusual. It's different. And there are lots of, you know, performance spaces that still exist, like the Poetry Project, you know, but they're not, it's not a store. They're not selling things. It's more like they've been, you know, and they're beyond broke, you know, places that are still around, or that lasted a long time, as you have done, But I think a difference is that you've maintained this commitment to the physical objects.
Yeah. Well, I like that. I think it's kind of a joke, but it's really true. I believe in the retail experience of art. I believe that a person should be able to walk down the street with an interest and find their way into a place and then discover things for themselves. And then hopefully be able to take some things home with them.
Right.
And pay for them.
You know, well, obviously, right. Not take them home, but pay for them. Yeah. But that's in some ways reminiscent of what Doug Messerly did with Sun and Moon having a store in L.A., that idea that you could walk in just off the street and find great art that was affordable that you could buy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because it's in a book, it might be kind of dismissed by some people because it's just an inexpensive object. But it is art in that way,
A lot of times they were, you know, even a lot of the first titles we had were mimeograph. And then we also had letterpress titles and then everything in between. But in each case, one of the things that my taste ran to was that if it was beautifully designed, it didn't really make too much difference what tool produced it. You know, if it was designed to the limitations of that tool and the limitations of the material the tool operated on, and it expressed in some way what was in the writing that was enclosed, then that made it something desirable for us.
Right.
So
you didn't, that's another thing too, that would be you have a broad aesthetic so that unlike certain people, like there are retailers who specialize in collectible literary work and they are carving out a kind of space that says it's not just the literature, it's the artistic expression and those are going to be more expensive books potentially, whereas you have a broader view. Yeah. You have the mimeo art that Carl Jung might have made and the fine press books that Perishable Press did. I'm sure you carried those.
Yeah,
some of
them,
we
did.
Uh-huh.
And then Elizabeth Press and so
right.
on. And I had discovered some things already before we got to Milwaukee. There was a little store called Call Me Ishmael in Saukville, Michigan.
Saugatuck,
Michigan. Sorry, Saukville's in Wisconsin. Saugatuck, Michigan. I walked in there, and it's kind of funny. You know, in this same place I discovered Charles Bukowski, Days Run Away Like Wild Horses Over the Hills. It has a wonderful epigraph in the front of it. Put your name up in lights, put it up in 8.5 by 11 mimeo. and also the Norton editions of Louis Zukowski's collected shorter poems, you know, the two volume. And so I'd picked those up before I got to Milwaukee. But Zukowski and Bukowski couldn't really be more different from each other.
Even though their names rhyme almost.
but it's in the same little place in Michigan. And, you know.
Well, that's probably what you would hope that somebody would say about Woodland Pattern.
Mm-hmm.
I went in there when I was 19 years old. I didn't know anything about poetry. And I suddenly got an education by walking around the store.
Yeah.
And I assume that's happened to some extent in Milwaukee.
Well, I did, the whole relationship our relationship in literature is these series of kind of circles that intersect, and then you fall into another circle, and that leads you. You know, I mean, it's amazing. You know that Basho poem about the frog.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how many, but you've continued to do live events, right, for all this time.
Yeah.
You also started doing workshops and classes.
Yeah.
And so now, how many days of the year are there live events in the store, would you say?
At the last count, and this counts things like a weekly seniors writers group.
Mm-hmm.
It's an average of 3 events a week.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it is.
And you've been doing this for a long time.
Yes, although it started not
started
as big
with
as
a bang,
that.
Those
yeah.
first few years. One, right. one year we did 140 events, and these were readings, mostly readings.
And for the audience for your events, does it draw on, I mean, is it a, is it community or is it college or is it a mixture of people that come?
It's kind of a mixture. For a long time, you know, we located away from the university because I was
We could afford it.
I was pissed off, you know, because I went through school and virtually everything that I was becoming interested in hadn't been exposed to me. I didn't even have a good reading list. You know, which I think college at best is provides you with a really reading list, and if then it's up to you. But I was a little, you know, felt like things had been concealed, and I didn't like that. I'm a Democrat at heart. I mean, small D Democrat.
Yeah.
I think another thing that started way at the beginning was the idea that everything we did needed to be done really well and extend the experience of what our mission would be so that people could find the contemporary classics that haven't been named yet. So when we sent out what we called a newsletter to send events, announcements about people who are coming to read. And the other thing is, I talk in parentheses, so I'm going to go sideways here. We never wanted to do stuff that we couldn't sustain, so we were very careful and thrifty. So when we mailed things out, we had a great printer that we went to, a family printer, and they said, well, we'll give you our cutoffs. We won't charge you for the paper because we hate wasting things, but you know, you pay us for printing. So Carl would go down and before the newsletter was supposed to be designed, and he would find all these different shapes of paper. And he would design each person's event to that shape of paper. And for about 15 years, we sent out a loose leaf newsletter with these beautiful little objects in. And it was so it would be very special for each thing. And the other thing.
Yeah, the theory was is that we'd send them an envelope loaded with paper and that they would open the envelope, go through it, decide what they were interested in, throw the rest away and put the thing they were interested in
on the
refrigerator.
On the bulletin board, on the refrigerator.
And that each thing would be a work, would be an expression, and there would be a poem or a visual work of art or some manifestation of what they were going to be presenting would be on that piece of paper.
Right.
So that would
So you went to the trouble of making the advertisement reflect the content.
Right.
Exactly.
That they were going to experience, which is pretty unusual, you know, I have to say.
I don't know.
Okay. Then the other thing that I thought was kept us busy but also was extremely special, first of all, thrifty, right? And then secondly, if we got a grant to bring people in, we didn't spend it on a hotel for them. They all stayed with us. So for years and years and years, we hosted all the writers, and while that was a lot of laundry, it was also a tremendous amount of wonderful conversation and getting to know people as people rather than commodities. And I think we built a reputation that way because we always wanted people to feel welcome as writers, not just because they were there and had a new book out. We very seldom scheduled people because it was a book release. It had to do with the quality of the work. And that seemed to work really, really well.
So over that, so how many writers, have you ever counted how many writers have appeared at Woodland Pattern?
Would that be thousands? It's daunting.
Yeah.
Although some people came back, so duplicated numbers are counted twice. Yeah, right, right.
And some people, and also people coming from out of town is different from people who are natives, locals, who would be,
Although we tried to do the presentations the same way. Because
No, I just mean in terms of the number of people that come to stay at your home.
Right.
The local people don't have to. I'm not drawing a distinction between local and outside.
Sure.
Because that's actually, you know, for some places, they mistreat their local writers because they want the stars from out of town or something.
And we know that everybody's local somewhere, so, exactly. You know, get them while they're young and fresh.
Yeah, Robert Ashley had an interview with Alvin Lucier, music from the ether, and he's talking with Lucier about, Lucier says he's invited to do a piece at the Denver Symphony Hall, and the board member is very anxious because the hall's in a circle, and he says, is this going to be good for music? And he says, well, I don't know if it'll be good for an orchestra, but it'll be very good for me. And then he goes on and talks about, he says, well, you know, Beethoven came from a little tiny town in Germany, off in the sticks, you know, and nobody remembers that. I mean, they don't, that's not part of the value of his experience.
That's
so
true.
So for a person to come, and, you know, Niedecker came from 45 miles away from Milwaukee. Niedecker, I could tell, I still say she's, well, to my taste, one of the five or six best writers of the 20th century, and I think she's being proven.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Laurie Niedecker because we have that shared interest, but also because you guys have become really involved with and Laurie Niedecker's work has become more well known, but there's also this whole big, now I think of big attention or big amount of attention paid to her in Wisconsin, which up until, you know, maybe last 25 years was not happening. So you've probably, probably know more about that than I do because you're there. So maybe you could talk about what goes on that has to do with Laureen.
Oh, well, it's a complicated story as always. I was a big fan of Niedecker and Paul Metcalf. We had him in town for a residency. This sounds like a sidebar, but it's not. At the theater, he had written a play and now he was directing it. At the theater, it was based loosely on some of the work he'd done in Appalachia and Genoa and I-57, so we were going for a ride. We needed to pick up Ann's work, and we're in Lake Geneva, and it's not very far from Fort Atkinson.
Yep.
And we say, well, why don't we go see if any of Niedecker's books are in the Fort Atkinson's library? And so we go over there, and there they are. Yeah, I mean, a good part of her library, her personal library, was in circulation
right.
at the Dwight Foster Library in Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin. And Paul's book Genoa from Jargon Society and a lot of other Jargon Society books were in circulation. Paul was thrilled, and so we're talking with the librarian. She says, "Well, now we have some more of her books in the basement. Would you like to look at them?" She says, "You know, they're just the paperbacks and stuff." And so we go down, and there are the books that Charles Reznikoff printed, and then George Oppen and the Objectivist Press
right.
stuff.
All these people that she knew.
Yeah, and
but they were paperback,
right.
So.
Yeah, paperback or real slim volumes.
Right.
You know,
yeah, they were books of poetry.
And so here we are. We're standing next to this shelf of history, and Paul's just glowing with using this company, and they'd had a board meeting in this room where this shelf was, and on the table was a plate of cookies and a pitcher of lemonade, and Paul and I kept glancing at it, and finally we kind of winked at each other and went over and poured lemonade and grabbed a cookie, and just as we did, we heard the click, click, click of the librarian down the hall.
So she comes in the room, and they've kind of like put the cookies behind their backs or whatever, and she just turned around, she said, "Would you like another cookie?" And that was Mary Gates, who was a wonderful supporter of the Niedecker process, and Carl found letters in the Reznikoff books. I mean, he found notes, ephemera in there.
In Noel Stock's biography of Ezra Pound, Niedecker had a essay she'd basically written and folded into the cover of the book. And there's all this ephemera. So she says to us, well, you know, Gail, when Al Millen decided to get rid of Nitocker's library, Gail got all the best ones. He got the hardcover ones. And now Nancy starts laughing because Paul's face fell.
Yeah. His wife, Nancy, was with him for the theater project.
But we were all laughing. So I went out there a month later and I said, you know, never fear, you got some really wonderful, irreplaceable things. And then I became friends with, so it turned out that Mary Gates and Marilla Fugie and Gail and Bonnie Robb formed kind of the basis of a local group that was interested in Nitocker. Gail was a friend of Nitocker, you know, a neighbor actually on Black Hawk Island. He taught history in the high school, and his wife Bonnie taught Latin, and they developed a friendship. Basically, they'd seen Nitocker walking back and forth on the island, were curious, and then somebody introduced them, and I think her lawyer Fred Hobie said, you know, you really need to know this lady, and they became friends. So, thanks to Gail, just before she died, she put the manuscript of Darwin in Gail's mailbox, and so when Sid Corman collected the manuscripts for Blue Chicory and Darwin was in it, Gail read it and compared it to his manuscript and discovered that Corman had the line breaks weren't right. He'd done it off of a tape. He'd transcribed a tape and recorded the only tape that Nitocker ever gave.
Right.
And so he'd misunderstood wholly, the H-O-L-Y, as holy, W-H-O-L-L-Y.
Yes.
So his holy slowly mulled over matter. I think I reversed it. He added holy, H-O-L-Y. But nevertheless, it totally altered the meaning, although the pun was obviously there. So it's not radically altered, but there were things like that all through it. And so Gail, you know, was very meticulous in his attention to Nitocker. He didn't understand a lot of her, but then hardly anybody does. I mean, Nitocker defies assumption. I mean, the latest one. We're now involved in publishing some monographs about Nitocker. The first one's by a talk that Jenny Pinberthy gave in 2003, and the second one is by an old newspaper guy, Paul Hayes, and then Martha Berglund, who's a pretty fine poet and fiction writer, together had done a biography of Increase Allen Lapham. And there was a poem that everybody knew was incorporating Lapham, the Ace of the Great, Increase Allen Lapham, please pay particular attention to my pets, the grasses. But nobody knew, and Paul Hayes discovered it because they'd gone through the Allen Lapham archive at the University of Wisconsin. He discovered a letter that Lapham had written to somebody about a conversation he'd had with a guy he called Poet Percival. Well, Jenny had always assumed that Poet Percival was Percival Bysshe Shelley. Not right. Everybody basically assumed that, but nobody could find a lode anywhere, L-O-D-E, anywhere in Shelley. And that turns out that Poet Percival was a miner who'd had his claim jumped, a lead miner, who'd had his claim jumped by a sucker. So I'm just about everything that people assumed about that poem is radically wrong, and that's the way she operates. I mean, you know, so a lot of us, when I was first reading, there were a lot of assumption about her being an isolated, kind of naive poet, which turned out to be wrong. And, you know, I mean, you know.
Well, that's a sort of romanticism of some of the people around her, I think. And
so the title of our monograph series, it's What Region? Because she had given a copy of T&G to the Milwaukee University of Wisconsin Milwaukee Library, and they didn't respond, so she called them up a few weeks later and said, did you receive the thing, or did it get lost in the mail? And they said, well, yeah, we received it. We filed it with Regional Materials. And she says, well, what region? You know, London?
Right.
New York?
Right.
Well, she had to resist being categorized.
Yeah, right. Well,
so, but there is a Niedecker Festival every year now.
In the fall.
You guys are involved with that? Yeah.
And actually, that came out of the 2003 Centenary Conference.
Which we organized.
Which we organized with Jenny's. Jenny, and it wasn't with her assistance. She was
involved completely.
Yeah, completely. And people came from 10 different countries, which was amazing. Sid Corman came.
From Japan.
From Japan. Yeah. And it was a huge event. It took a couple of years to plan. And after it was over, and we all slept a while, then things started evolving from it. And one of the things that evolved was this Friends of Niedecker group, which has become... now is very strong and has these yearly festivals. Another thing that came out of it was the emphasis on placing Niedecker as much as possible in the state curriculum. And that actually is now taking place. Yeah.
So do you feel like, I mean, is that, do you do other work with poets of Wisconsin to support their work, or is that not necessarily a theme for you? Is it, or it was just because of the aesthetics of Laurie Niedecker that you felt close to that you became involved with her? But are there other poets in Wisconsin?
We've had a lot to do with the public library decided they wanted a poet laureate program, and they included us in that planning. And so there's been quite a few local writers that we, one of the ones, Antler, who was friends with Ginsberg, was named the poet laureate with quite a bit of trepidation on the part of the library because he's fairly flagrantly gay, and
that was the second poet laureate. So that was quite a few years ago.
Yeah,
but they
first
did.
The first poet laureate was John Cady, who's won several awards, major awards, and was friends with Kenward Elmsley and John Ashbery and the New York School people, and then it turns out, I think, that without exception, up until now, well, now there might be one exception, but virtually everybody that's been a poet laureate has been involved with Wooden Pattern. But it's not a conflict of interest, you know. It's a small world.
Well, or it means you have good taste, and you know you're involved with people who are really good. But so, I mean, but Wisconsin is part of your being because
but making and trading. You know, I mean, basically.
Yeah.
So we wanted to pay attention. But our feeling was that we didn't want to be a regional bookstore and just do regional poets in isolation. That wouldn't be very interesting. And then we also didn't want to just be importing things, you know, and becoming a kind of a narrow thing like
that. We wanted to present all the work in a similar kind of context so that whoever is reading is a special person. And it's not just now we have the big star from New York and then we have, you know, some pretty nice person from Milwaukee. That's not it at all, you know. There's always the same context of being in the pantheon of poetry. So that's been really important. And the same way with the books that we've accepted or that are in Woodland Pattern, if you are a poet and you want to bring your book and have it on consignment, we will take it. And it can be Mimeo, and we've had those. We've had some amazing different ways of putting books together, some more sophisticated than others. But they're all in that huge, huge life that's poetry. So if you come in and you say, well, I don't like poetry, I don't know much about it, then we'll say, well, what are you interested in? You know, and if a person says, well, I like cooking, well, so we can find poets that write about cooking. And if they're interested in sports, there are plenty of poets that write about sports. It doesn't have to be separated from what people think is their real lives. It's always part of your real life.
I think that's really good. Well, I think that actually is a great place for us to conclude, because it sums up so much of what Woodland Pattern is about. And I assume that you will continue to do this for into the future.
Yeah,
so, yeah. Well, I really want to thank you for spending the time. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and publishing and writing. I've been talking to Ann Kingsbury and Carl Gartung of Woodland Pattern in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I recommend, if you're hearing this and you've never been there, that you should make the effort to go, or at least go to the website, which is woodlandpattern.org. Thanks so much.